It's now my pleasure to introduce my friend Bill Hatzman from Visalia.
Thank you, Justin. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bill Hatzman. And by the grace of a God that I don't fully understand, and a lot of really, really kind and generous people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a family that loves me, I stand here today celebrating 13 years of continuous sobriety, and I didn't expect the emotion that just came over me to show up. I'm sure glad I can feel that today. I thought I would take a little different approach to this talk. I have these ideas that I think there may be some people in our midst who can sometimes benefit from some fairly specific examples of the work that we do here in AA. And so I'm planning to get a little bit vulnerable with you tonight. I'm going to tell you some things about myself that I might even rather that you didn't know. And the reason that I think it's important to tell you some of those things is because of the profound changes that have happened in my life that allowed me to be the man that I am today. I told you I haven't had a drink in over 13 years. I've had the same job now for 10 years. I've been happily married to my wife for over 9 years now. I'm welcome in my in the homes of my family members. Some kind of crazy stuff. When I'm invited, I'm really proud of this. When I'm invited to attend family gatherings with my family, it's very common for them to ask me to lead a prayer before we eat or whatever we're doing. And man, that is not who got here 13 years ago. I have a lot of really special people here tonight. If I haven't met you yet, I hope to get to know you. Alex, I met you on Sunday, and I'm really delighted to see that you're here today, my friend. I hope I'll say something that might make Alcoholics Anonymous look attractive to you, because that's what people did for me. My friend John Bonds goes with me frequently to places that a lot of people don't want to go. And he helps me to do the things that give me the life that I have today. And that's not enough. John had to get sneaky on me. Several weeks ago, he went and he got this 13-year chip that he gave me, and he gave it to my wife, and he told her not to tell me that he had given it to her. He wanted to show some affection, I guess, maybe is the word. So this morning when I woke up, my wife told me that not too many people get a 13-year chip from a naked woman. That's just the start. I've got a good life today. So This is a large print version of the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I carry it with me not as often as I'd like, but I have it with me frequently, and I use this as a guide. The directions for how to live a better life are in this book. The problem is that if you're anything like me, when you get here, it appears to be written in Chinese. After having someone guide me through this literature to show me what it really means, I can tell you that it's written in very plain English. I just wasn't able to comprehend it when I first started. And you might have that same experience. And if you do, I want to encourage you to do some of the things that I and some of my other friends do a lot. We go to these meetings where we study the book, and we try to pull out of the pages meaning about the things that we're going through today. And it's remarkable the way these guys in the 1930s wrote down the way they acted, the way they felt, the way they drank, and how it's possible that in 2018 I could relate to that just astounds me. But that's my experience. There's really nothing terribly extraordinary about me. I do believe that that the God that I don't fully understand uses perfectly ordinary people to do extraordinary things. And again, I'm just speaking from my experience. I've seen things happen that just can't possibly happen with people that come here and do this thing that we do. And I'm really glad that that the people that encountered me when I was new were kind and patient enough with me to let me be an adolescent. I don't really fully claim to be an adult still today, not emotionally and mentally, but I was especially immature when I got here. And I wanted to contest everything that people said, and I still do have this incorrect self-assessment. I have this dramatic way of over and underestimating myself. I tend to think that I'm either much better than I really am, or I think I'm much worse than I really am. And one of the things that the process of the 12 steps has allowed me to do is to come to an understanding of the truth about who I am. And as a result of the things that I've been taught to do here, I've been able to interact with a number of you, and I get to see God working in your lives, and that has changed me. I'm a believer today in things that I didn't believe in when I got here, and one of the most important things that's happened for me is understanding that this idea of a higher power is not some old gray guy in the clouds with thunderbolts looking to punish me, but rather some entity that wants to have a relationship with me. And we talk a lot in AA about things like prayer and meditation. And if you're anything like me, those words might be a little bit intimidating. They might kind of scare you. They might sound a little like smoke and mirrors. They did to me. And it's ridiculous that's the case given my upbringing, because I was given a very good upbringing. But nevertheless, the way that I understand prayer today is simply a conversation that I have with some power that's greater than me. We commonly use the word God to talk about that thing, right? And sometimes the word God gets really confusing, and it's easy to really get adversarial when words like God come up. But when I use the word God tonight, I want you to understand understand that what I'm trying to say is not about a particular religion or a particular set of beliefs. It's simply about whatever it is that you think might have more power in this universe than you, right? And I have my own understandings of what I call God, and I expect you have your understandings. But let's not let the fact that we have different understandings screw up the word God, right? Okay? So when I pray, I'm trying to have a conversation with that God that I'm trying to develop a relationship with. And then the idea of meditation is where I listen, and I want to be clear, I'm not talking about audible hallucinations. I'm not talking about hearing voices or seeing things that aren't really tangible. What I'm talking about is thoughts and intuitions and notions and ideas that come to my mind that weren't there before I sat quietly listening. And so the way that I've learned how to develop a relationship with my understanding of God is to talk to Him, and I say Him again. Please don't get caught up in that. I don't know that God has a gender. I don't know. Okay, these are colloquialisms. I realize sometimes they cause friction for us, but. What I want to do is I want to share a prayer that's very common. I use this very commonly. I used to say I do it every night because that was true. I did it every night. And then, you know, life got good and I got busy and sometimes I don't. And I'm just being honest. Sometimes I forget to do this. Sometimes I want to watch another half hour of TV and sometimes I just don't do it. But by hanging around with you people, I have a better chance of being reminded of the benefits of doing this stuff. And so when I first got here, this idea of prayer really kind of frightened me. I really didn't know what that looked like. And so I want to share with you a prayer that I do very commonly. Look, I'm not trying to tell you how to pray. I'm giving you an example of how one person does this prayer stuff. Okay? So it goes something like this. And again, if you're really not in a place where you can deal with this right now, just hum to yourself quietly while I go through this. It'll be done shortly, right? And nobody's gonna sprinkle you on your way out. We do pass a hat, but that's just to pay the rent for the room. Okay, here we go. Heavenly Father, I want to thank you for another sober day here on earth. I want to thank you, Lord, for all of your blessings. I want to ask you to help me to see, share, and to be good stewards with them all. Lord, I ask that you help us to be the men and women that you would have us be. Please show us your plans for us and help us to have the courage to follow that path. Lord, I pray that that all of your children would come to know you, that they would find the joy and the peace and the love and the freedom that I found in you. I'll ask you, Lord, to please help me to be helpful to others, especially when I don't want to be. And I pray for all those who are suffering that they may find comfort in you. It's in your name that I pray. Amen. That's it, man. That's my idea of prayer. And meditation, like I said, is when I try to sit quietly and it's amazing the way ideas come to me. And you know what? I don't always have to be sitting quietly for those ideas to occur to me. I can't tell you how many times I've been sitting in an AA meeting and somebody reads the daily reflection and there's something in that that just sings at me about something that happened recently or a problem I'm struggling with. And then somebody will share about their experience with, you know, what that person read. And I find myself connecting with ideas that I didn't have when I got to that meeting. And that can be meditation, in my experience. So I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about what I was like. I'm going to keep this kind of brief. Let me go a little different direction. There is some information in this book. There's a lot of information in this book. I want to point out two things that are in this book. That's it. Just two that are frankly very counterintuitive. They don't add up. They don't make sense. Right? Okay. So the first one is this book actually says. The book of Alcoholics Anonymous actually says that for the alcoholic, alcohol is not the problem. that is crazy. I mean, if that ain't the problem, what are we all doing here? What it says is that my problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. That's the root of my problem. And in the pursuit of things that I want for me, I inevitably cut people off, deprive other people of the things that they want. I get in their way, and the way I see it, they retaliate without any provocation. I'm a victim. And, you know, there's a great deal of power in being a victim. Man, there's a lot of power in being a victim. And, you know, it doesn't look like it on the surface, but, you know, if we're all honest about it, I mean, how many of us have gone to our friends and told them a story about something that somebody else did to you, and you tell it in just the right way so that you are sure that they take your side in the argument, right? I mean, I think most of us have probably done those kinds of things, and that's really kind of one example of that kind of thing. So my problem, it turns out, is really not alcohol. Now, I have to be careful with that because it turns out that alcohol is still a problem for me. And the way that I learned that was through going through the first step, right? And the first step asked me to look at two different things. It asked me to look at being powerless over alcohol, and it asked me to look at whether or not my life is manageable, or it uses another word, it says unmanageable. And I really didn't understand. I thought I knew what all that meant, but I know today that I really didn't understand that. And I also know today that 13 years after coming to some basic understanding about what those terms mean, I'm still learning what those terms mean in different angles and flavors of it. And so when we talk about being powerless over alcohol, you know, the real simple kind of litmus test there is, you know, if I find myself drinking and I don't know, let's say, okay, because now I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like. I'm at my sister's house for Thanksgiving, and I'm having a grand old time. And I know that I'm going to get in my car, and I'm going to leave at some point this evening. Now, if I'm drinking, everybody knows the math on this, right? It's about a drink an hour. An ounce of liquor an hour is what the legal limit is. And I don't know about you guys, but I happen to possess a phenomenal ability to drive. Or so I think. And so what happens for me is I might have one drink. I might even get there thinking, no, I'm not going to drink tonight, right? And then somehow my mind changes and I have the first drink. And then you know what that first drink does is it makes the second one look a little bit better. And then the third one, well, I probably shouldn't, but yeah. And then after that, it's just like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, right? Or whatever. And I didn't mean to suggest that I'm a big, bad drinker, okay? But anyway, like I could drink 10 beers. But the point is that that there's something different that happens to me when I put alcohol into my system. And we talk about this in some kind of scientific ways, right? So alcohol, you guys probably all know this, right? But alcohol on the regular ordinary human being is it's called a central nervous system depressant. And so 9 people out of 10, about 90% of the humans, when they put alcohol into their system, it sedates them, it brings them down. I watched my sister, her eyes get kind of droopy after a glass of wine. And but see, that's not what happens to me. You know what happens to me? I want to go on an adventure. I mean, it's time to go have some fun, right? I want to drive fast and listen to some loud music. And that is an abnormal reaction to the chemical ethyl alcohol, which is what we drink. So just because my problem isn't alcohol doesn't mean I don't have a problem with alcohol. And you know, I love it. This guy, I think it was Clancy, said, you know, if that was the only problem, then going to jail or going to a treatment home would pump out winners one after the next because, you know, you just don't take that first drink. And the problem is that that my mind has this curious way of forgetting what happened the last time I drank. And so I do these things. Maybe the best way I can describe it is, after I've had enough alcohol in my system, I begin to behave in ways that are contrary to my value system. I do things that I would not do in a sane, rational state of mind. And over the years, what happened is I continued to do these things that were against my values. And the funny thing is, if you're like me, your sense of right and wrong changes over time, right? You know, all those things you said you'd never do that, you know, one by one you start doing. And it gets worse and worse, and it gets really, really, really hard to be around me when I'm drinking because you know it's not gonna end well. And So that's the one part of the powerlessness piece is that you know I can't safely start drinking and I can't seem to stay stopped. I can't seem to keep from starting again. And that's my dilemma with alcohol. And when we look at the unmanageability piece of it, one way it was kind of broken down to me is, you know, if I looked at my life and I tried to make my life, I don't know, equate it to a business or a team, let's say a business, and we're looking at all the different aspects of a business, right? Is the business profitable? Is it a good community, a good member of the community? Is the business giving its patrons good value for their money, right? And that's for a business. But if you apply the same kind of principles to my life, you find that you're never getting a fair shake from me, right? In life, I'm the 51% guy. I'm always getting more than my half in any kind of deal that we're doing. You ever done that? Yeah, yeah. And it wears people out. So what happens is the consequences begin to add up, and the quality of my life, the experience of my life, is not what I want it to be. I start spending money paying for things that I didn't want to pay for: fines, fees, you know, bail, and repairing other people's stuff, things like that. And my relationships are taking a heavy toll. So for me, the first step with AA was to understand that that I have a problem that I by myself can't solve, and so my sponsor turned me to the second step, and we looked at this idea that maybe I was not behaving rationally, maybe I was behaving insane. And you know, again, if I want to have relationships with people in my life and I'm treating those people poorly, that doesn't add up, right? It doesn't make any sense. I kind of coined this phrase. I don't know if you guys have ever heard this, but it's alcoholic math, right? So this is where you got a guy, a friend of yours, right? He comes to you and he says, hey, man, check it out, man. My landlord loves me. I pay rent like 3 days before the end of the month, so I'm always paid up. And, man, he loves that. My neighbors, as a matter of fact, my neighbors had me over for dinner last night to thank me for watching their kids. And the groundsman that keeps the place up, he left a gift for me because I made a point of cleaning up the pool after everybody else was in there last weekend, and I'm getting evicted. You see the math? It doesn't add up, right? Yeah, and that's what happens when I don't have a good sense of management in my own life, and I do things that don't make any sense. And so my sponsor got me to the third step, and he said, well, you know, we've got a problem, and we have a solution is that we're going to get a new manager and we're going to try to start pursuing a sane way of life. And we have some work that's going to help us to do that. But that work is not going to start until you make a conscious decision to actually do that work. And so we got down on our knees and we said a prayer, and then he sent me off on my way to do a fourth step. And I don't know what some of the people that may be newer to this fellowship are hearing about Four Steps these days, but 13 years ago, you'd think that a fourth step was, you know, this harrowing experience. That's the way I recall it. And so there was a little bit of trepidation about doing this fourth step, whatever that was. And there was also, I don't know if you guys ever do this, but I have a tendency to kind of read ahead. And so I read ahead a little bit, and I got to that 8 and 9 stuff, and there were some people that I knew were not ready to make amends to me. And so I thought, okay, yeah. Thanks, Elge. I was hoping somebody would track with that one, yeah. Yeah, so it's the point of the 8th and 9th step is that I'm going to restore the damage I've done to other people, not that they are going to restore for damage to me. But that's how I was thinking. And so... I didn't see any real reason to rush ahead into step 4 because, you know, that would lead to 5 and 6 and 7. Next thing you know, we're at 8 and 9. And I'm really glad that it happened this way, but I actually admitted to my sponsor that. And he said, well, hey, man, check it out. Let's not worry about that right now. He was real big into the present moment. You know, what's happening right now, man? And he was teaching me how to be okay just right now. And I'd say, yeah, man, but my girlfriend's breaking up with me. And he'd go, yeah, but for the next hour that we're in this meeting, there is nothing that's going to change about that. So why don't you just be here in this meeting? And so he was big about the present moment. And he said, let's not worry about that. Let's go ahead and get ahead. And he asked me to do something. He asked me to make a list of all of the people. Actually, he started just with people. The book says institutions and principles, but he knew he was working with some shoddy material here. So he asked me to write a list of all the people that ever pissed me off. And I thought, wow, you know, gosh, I'm not mad at anybody. Let me tell you, it's been my experience that if you ever find yourself looking at some step work and you're saying, wow, you know, this really doesn't even apply to me. Like if you get to 6 and 7 and you go, man, I'm just plumb out of character defects. Let me just give you a caution. You're probably in for a lot of writing. And that was the experience for me. So I began to write down the names of people, and then he introduced the idea of institutions. So you know what I found out is, like, I had been pissed off at anybody I'd ever had a relationship with, and he knew that if he wasn't careful, I would spin off and go off into Never Never Land writing this, you know, infinite list of people. So he asked me to write down up to 10 names. That was it, 10 names, and come back with it, and then he'd give me the next thing to do. And so through that process, I began to get a different perspective of myself. And so what I want to do tonight is I want to kind of walk you through how I did that process. And I'm going to give you some specific examples. I'm a little bit embarrassed of this. Not really. Not really, because I'm not stuck there now. If I were stuck there now, I would be embarrassed of this. But the company that I work for got acquired, and it got bought by a bigger group. And so I had worked for this small company for the last 10 years. And I was really, really fortunate to get to work with some good people. And so as a result of the people that I was working with, I distinguished myself on 8 of the 10 years I was working for them as their top performer. And if you ever find yourself in that kind of position, there are some really cool things that go along with that, right? It's common for people to praise you. It's common for that for me. I also found that I was extended a level of authority that really I had no business having. So because of the history that I had with this company, I was able to ask people to do things that I didn't have the authority to ask them to do, and they would be happy to do it for me. And that's a really cool trip to be on, man. That's a good deal. And so now with this new company, that's all gone. I don't have that swag anymore. And I kind of don't like that I don't have that swag anymore. And it goes a little farther than that. It actually goes to the fact that this is April, so the last 4 months, half of the people that I work with are no longer employed. So they let half of our company go. And I'm kind of thinking like, well, great. Now I've got to do the work of three or four other people just to keep my head up. I kind of feel like maybe they're setting me up to fail, right? I mean, they're asking me to do more work than three or four people could successfully do. And they're not recognizing us for the work that we're doing. And I start to get kind of resentful. I'm starting to feel like they don't value me. And I think that they're setting me up to fail, and I'm afraid. Well, I'll get to the fear in a minute. Anyway, so I'm upset with my company. I'm resentful at my employer. And the reason that I'm upset with them is because they don't value me, they're setting me up to fail, and I don't get all these nice perks that I used to have. And so in this process that I was taught to walk through, I need to look at what we call seven areas of self. These are seven different ways that I perceive myself through the eyes of myself or the eyes of other people. And this can be a little bit hard to follow, so I'm going to try to keep it as simple as I can. The first of those areas is called self-esteem. And in this, on the surface, it looks like I'm supposed to determine how my self-esteem is affected by this change, by the way things are happening. And typically, my instinctive reaction is, well, I guess my self-esteem is down, or it's depreciated as a result. I think less of myself. But that's really not what this the process that I've been taught to use, it's really not what it's looking for. Here's the thing. If I thought that I was not a good employee, then I wouldn't be upset by people treating me as though I'm not valuable. I wouldn't be upset. I would be in agreement with that. So what this form kind of helps draw out of me is the fact that even though I don't walk around saying this, and frankly, I'm even embarrassed to admit it to you, okay? But this is very cathartic. It's very healing. What I have to recognize is that there is a piece of me that really thinks I am a valuable employee. In fact, I'm not just a valuable employee. I'm the best damned employee they've ever had. I did tell you earlier that I'm prone to overestimating myself. And I think I'm a great team member. And so then on this form, what I'm asked to do is I'm asked to find the fear that's the opposite of that idea, right? And the fear that I have is that I'm not valued, or that I may be unemployed. Right? I mean, that's real fear, okay? I'm asked to look at something we call pride. So in this one, I'm asked to think about how other people see me or how they feel about me. These are roles that I've assigned to other people. And so in this one, I've learned, for example, that I think that others should clamor to praise me and appreciate me. They should reward me, and they should recognize me. Now, look, let's just be clear. I'm not walking around thinking, who's not praising me? Right? But here's the thing. If the lack of praise is pissing me off, there's a part of me that really thinks I deserve some kind of praise or recognition. And so then I'm asked to look at the fear that's associated with that, or the opposite of that. And again, I'm afraid that I'm not appreciated, that I won't be rewarded, or that I'm not recognized. Next, I go to ambition. And here I'm asked what I want to happen here. What is it? What is the outcome that I'm looking for here? And that's actually a pretty easy one. I want to trust my employer. I want to know that they're looking out for me. And the fear is that maybe they're not. And again, maybe that's going to end up in me being unemployed. Or maybe I'm going to have to face the very difficult... Show of hands, any unemployed people in the room? Is it a bitch to find a job when you don't have a job?
Yeah,
we know that, don't we? So I got a job right now, and I don't want to have to go through the trouble of doing this job and looking for another job. And I don't want to find myself, without a job, needing to find a job. So that's some real fear there. And so then I look at security. And these are the things that I need in this situation for me to be okay. And so one of the things that I felt I needed here was to be told the truth. And I have this suspicion that this other company bought my company to basically strip it of all of its valuable resources and then cast the rest of us off on shore, right? And if that's what you're going to do, just tell me the damn truth, right? That's what I think. Again, I'm not walking around going, tell me the truth. But I wouldn't be upset. I wouldn't be upset about the notion that I feel like I'm being deceived if I didn't feel like they owed me the truth, right? And I also want to be respected and appreciated and valued to be okay. And the fear that's associated with those things is that I'll be deceived, I'll be disrespected, and again, not appreciated or valued. The next area of self I look at is personal relations. And this is where I'm supposed to look at my deep-seated beliefs about how this relationship is supposed to look. So what is an employer-employee relationship supposed to look like? And so to that I wrote, employers inspire their employees and employers help their employees to succeed. And the thing that's the fears that are the opposite of that are that I'm disregarded, that I'm ignored, that I'm not helped, or that I'm left to fail. The sixth area of self that we look at is something that sometimes is called sex relations. I think maybe a better definition of this is gender relations. And for all the guys in the crowd, if I were to ask you what you think of, let's say, John Wayne. I don't know, some of you are probably too young to know John Wayne, but John Wayne was a character that in my mind, anyway, was like the man's man. I mean, man, if you could be John Wayne, you'd be the best. I mean, you know, nobody would mess with you. And so this is my ideas about how I think real men as employers should treat other people, or how I as an employee as a real man should be treated. And so in this case, I think that a real man from a leader perspective, that a real man inspires and helps their employees to be successful, right? And that for myself as a real man, if I'm really John Wayne, my employer is going to do everything they can to help me. And what I'm afraid of is that maybe I'm a failure. I'm afraid of being unemployed, and frankly, I'm afraid of being abandoned. The last area of self is pocketbook. And this one doesn't always apply, but in this case, it certainly does. What they're looking for is how does this resentment affect my finances? And so my thought here is that no one should undervalue the importance of my contributions. And the fear that's the opposite of that is that I won't have what I need. So this is what we commonly refer to as the third column, the first three columns, the first, second, and third column. These are all shown here on page 65, if you've ever cracked the spine of these books, you guys remember seeing that kind of funny looking thing? So that's what they're trying to drive. What I just talked you through is what they're trying to drive here. And I had to have somebody walk me through a very specific example for this to make sense, because it didn't make sense the way it was laid out here. And you know, the funny thing is, and again, I'm kind of embarrassed about this, but the truth is, I spent 6 weeks, I am not lying to you, I spent 6 weeks with a piece of paper trying to figure out how much space to leave between the names. You know what I'm saying? It's insane, man. You know what my sponsor told me he said? He said, first we write the names, then we get another piece of paper. And then we write one name on that piece of paper, and you got all the space you need, baby. So those are the first three columns. This is where it gets interesting. This is where everything changes. We turn this over. In the book, it says we took another look at this list. We looked at it from a different angle. And so I'm asked, how have I done the things that I've resented in column two? That's the person. I'm sorry. Column two is the resentment. So in my case, they don't value me. They're setting me up to fail. How have I done those things to the person or other people? I need to tell you something. I broke this out last Thursday. I was edgy for a few weeks, at least a few weeks. Wound up with all of this stuff. And if you'd have asked me, is there something wrong? I would have said, I'm cool, man. Everything's cool. What are you talking about? But I was edgy. And last Thursday, it finally occurred to me, dummy, you know what to do with this. And I broke out this sheet and I wrote this. I wrote this in less than 15 minutes. The first thing that occurred to me, I've failed to praise my wife and remind her how valuable she is to me. Wow. I've failed to encourage her when she's expressed fear. I've also failed to encourage and to thank. Oh, I'm sorry. One other little detail. So Thursday's when I wrote this. Wednesday, my boss called me and he was announcing the comp plan for the next year, and I knew what they were going to do. They doubled my quota for this year, and he was kind of excited. He wanted to tell me that he had managed to negotiate a raise for me. And my reaction to him was, is that retroactive? That's what I bring to the table on my own. I'm not a good manager. And it wasn't. And I failed to thank him. I failed to thank him for the fact that I was the half of the company that still has a job. I failed to thank him for the raise that he gave me when other people lost their jobs. I failed to thank him for all the things that he has done. He has done a lot. My boss has done a lot to help me succeed. But see, all I want to focus on is all this other stuff. So what this does is it gives me a new perspective on my situation. And from there, I'm asked to look at the fourth column of this inventory. And it's asking me, where have I been self-seeking? And this is looking for specific actions. And this was really clear. I've had a poor attitude. I've criticized and failed to show appreciation for the people that have been helping me and for my wife at home. I haven't recognized the fact, again, that I got to keep my job and I got to grow it. I mean, I have a bigger job now. Then I look at selfishness, and this is where my attitudes come in. And my attitude about this whole thing is, you know, it's not enough. Anything they do or to show that they value me is never going to be enough. I always, for crying out loud, you know, I don't know if I said this, the raise they gave me last Wednesday was the biggest merit increase I've ever had in my life. And I'm complaining about it. And my attitude is, it's, you know, it's not enough. We should be retroactive to my birth. Then I'm asked to look at where I've been dishonest and what delusion that this attitude is coming out of. And the delusion is that they want me to fail. See, you know, the crazy thing is, if you think that your boss wants you to fail, you have got to be an idiot. Think about it. If you fail, they fail. Nobody wants you to fail, man. That's all up in here. That's all crazy talk. And then I'm asked to look at my fears. And what was I afraid of that was causing that delusion? I was afraid I was going to lose my job. I know from doing enough inventory that from losing my job, the next thing that happens is I'm alone and I'm going to suffer and die in pain and misery, and everybody hates me. Does that sound rational to you? It's not rational. It's not rational at all. But see, I have to go through this whole exercise to pull the truth of my situation out. The last thing I'm asked to do in this is one of three part inventories for the fourth step. This is the resentment inventory. We also have a fear inventory and a sex inventory. That's coming up next, huh? I'm asked to look at the harm that I've caused, and I failed to show my love and appreciation for God's gift of a wife, and for a boss that supports me, and for the good team. I told you I had amazing teammates, and they made me all this success, and now I want to turn around and make it all about they suck, right? And what this process of this fourth step does for me is it gets me clear. It gets me a new perspective. It allows me to get free of the insane thoughts that run through my head. And I know that was a lot to throw at some of you that may have not had any of this experience. I hope that that if any of this resonated with you, especially the, you know, unmanageability and powerlessness stuff. If any of that resonated with you, I implore you, please find one of the men or women, okay, in this room who have had experience with this process and ask them to guide you through this process. It will change your life. My life is profoundly better than it was when I got here, and I have the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, a grace-filled God, and a bunch of lovely people to thank for that. Thank you.